So this week we're on international missions, and I intentionally put missions in November and the lesson on international missions the day before we actually have our first international mission as a church. So this will be kind of a long-term vision that I've pitched to the missions committee and myself I've had as the pastor of the congregation, long-term what we could do. So that's kind of what we're going over this morning, and some things that we could help people overseas through the lens of gift giving. So we have to ask ourselves, what are our gifts as the American church, and how can we give those to the global church, and what are their gifts that they can give back to us? So it builds mutual exchange. That's what we're talking about, reciprocity and gift giving and building relationships. So we're talking about international missions this week. So first, we have to ask ourselves, what are our gifts that we can give to other people as individuals or as a congregation? So graces are supernatural. They're given from God. We did not just magically. I always like to say it this way. I come from a family of hard workers. I didn't just wake up one day and say, I want to be a hard worker. That virtue or that grace was given to me from my parents. I just didn't wake up and say, I'm going to work really hard. I saw it from my dad, who got that virtue from his dad, and I'm assuming it goes even further back that way. But when you put it in the context of graces that are God-given or virtues, I think they're supernatural. So the gift myself as your pastor, I hope I have the gift of teaching. You guys can laugh at that one. It's been confirmed by the presbytery. That's why they have you preach a sermon. So my gifts are teaching, preaching, leadership, being able to moderate session, things such as that. But I don't have all the gifts. I'm not the whole entire body. The body has to work together in order to build itself up. No, those gifts that have been given to us by God are supernatural. So some people, I've mentioned this before, I'm okay at visits, and I visit people in the hospital and things like that, but that's not my strong point. But there's some people out there that are extremely good at it, and I would argue that those are supernatural graces given by God. They're just really good at the gift of mercy, for example. So I want to ask the question, how can we serve our brothers and sisters overseas? So I guess before I give the two things I think that we can give to the global church, has anybody ever thought about this? What are some of the strengths that the American church might have over against the global church that we could give to them? So I'm trying to get away from, sometimes I hear when people give testimony of missions, and they tend to elevate the American church over everybody else instead of trying to level the playing field and see it as, well, we have gifts that we do really well in the American church, and the parts of the global church do other things very, very well. So it's more of a reciprocity instead of a hierarchy, if that makes sense. So to think about it that way. So that's interesting that Tim said monetary gift giving, because that's one thing I think is our responsibility being in the American church. Even if we're in the middle class, we're in the top 4% richest people in the whole entire world. So that's our responsibility, should be giving monetary to missionaries. It should be no surprise that in the early church, the church in Rome was very blessed financially and became basically the epicenter of Christian missionary activity. If you needed to raise money, you went to Rome to get it, because that's where all the rich Christians lived. So that this is kind of embedded into the historical fabric of Christian missionaries. And I think the same thing could be said from the United States. But one thing that I think, after going to seminary and spending a ton of time with people from different countries, about a third or maybe even more of our students at Dallas Theological Seminary, for example, came from different countries. I mean, I have more friends that were from China or Korea than I could count. And actually, one of my good friends, Yang, came to my ordination service, so you guys met him. But one of the gifts that I see that the American church can give back is theological education. The impoverishment of education theologically overseas is they just don't have the resources that we do. I know Dean, for example, with Mainstay Ministries, the work you've done, you guys have done, I guess you could call it theological education, to be able to give that for free to people throughout the globe. So Dean has experience with it, and I kind of see that as the way forward. So that's the one gift I think the American church has, not just the American church, but all the church in the West. So England has really great resources, Germany going way back. So monetary support and theological education. So how could RPC work towards building relationships of reciprocity with throughout churches throughout the world? And I think it's monetary giving and theological education. So when I sit in my study and pray about these things, that's kind of the two things that the Lord gave to me. So if you can think of other ones that the American church does well, maybe you have to spend some time with more international people to kind of see in the first place what they do well, what we do well type of thing. So so opening remarks. I guess I have an obsession with hot dogs and hamburgers, but I was thinking about things that are particular to my experience growing up in America that I love. So hot dogs and hamburgers are some of them. Thank God Jesus did not eat pork so that I can. I know that's the joke. So the law doesn't have to abide on me. I can eat pork and enjoy it. And the other thing that I think about in Pennsylvania, because I like to think it through the lens of what are the cultural practices that I've introduced Sarah to that are distinctly from Pennsylvania that I love, like traditions that I grew up doing. And one of the things that we did in my family was pick black raspberries, which I just loved doing as a kid around the 4th of July time. So blackberries, black raspberries, hot dogs, and hamburgers were on my mind when I made this slide, kind of the things that we do in Western Pennsylvania. So mission work should be seen primarily through the lens of gift giving. If we do not view missions work through this lens, we will primarily see our relationship with international missions through the lens of efficiency, as Jamie pointed out, and altruism. So in other words, it's a fancy way of saying we're just cutting checks to people instead of building long-lasting relationships with them. Them being a blessing to us and us being a blessing to them and doing it over and over and over again. I'd like to think of it like a big circle. We bless them, they bless us back. We bless them, they bless us back. There are many things the American church does well, theological education, for example. However, there are things that we don't do well, such as isolated individualism. I forgot to press save and I fixed that typo. So that's one thing that the global church has really pushed me to understand, and being married to somebody that's from the global church, Americans are very much isolated individuals. And we don't realize that sometime until we actually spend time with brothers and sisters in Christ from different parts of the world. They really kick our butts with being a part of the global, or being a part of the body of Christ. So for example, if you wanted to do a new program, they're just rhythms and routines are more of what I think America used to look like before the 1960s. So a lot of us in this room kind of grew up in. So theological education we do better, but they kick our butts with isolated individualism. And I would actually expect if I magically put us all in Mexico and we all got to spend time with El Buen Pastor this coming week, that one of the things that would be a challenge to us and push us back is we would be more aware of our isolated individualism. When I lived in Mexico for 2 years, that was kind of the thing that shaped me that way. Or just the way we view time. I like to kick back and relax and enjoy myself when I'm eating with people now forever. That's just how Mexico shaped me. So one of the weirdest things, when I lived there for 2 years and came back to the United States, I went to go get breakfast with somebody from my church. And we went to Eden Park, and we literally sat down for 25 minutes, and he looked at his watch and said, "Oh, I got to get to work." And I thought to myself, that's kind of rude, because I just lived in Mexico, where if you're going to commit to getting breakfast with somebody, you're sitting down with them for about an hour, at least an hour and a half. Although from an American perspective, that can get a little bit annoying when you need the check. So one of the things that we normally do, and I'm sure we're going to have to do this week, is you always have to like point out to your server, I almost said savior, that would not be a correct grammar, and you say, "I need the check," and then they'll give it to you. They just kind of like let you hang out there and linger for a long time, not like in the United States where you might be hanging out a little bit too much and they might bring the check to your table to try to push you out the door so they can turn tables. One of the interesting things I believe is when you do spend time outside of your bubble, you don't really know what American civil religion is until you travel abroad. So isolated individualism. I thought more about what makes me distinctly a Western Pennsylvania kid growing up here when I lived in Mexico than I ever did when I lived in Western Pennsylvania. That's just the world. You don't really think about this stuff until you travel abroad. And then you think about, well, how do I raise my kids and keep between both worlds? So it's quite fun. So has anybody had this experience when traveling overseas, or maybe some weird things us Americans do that you never thought about? So I always like to think in sports, in terms of sports. If I had gone to a sporting event in Philadelphia and wore a Pittsburgh hat when I went to go see the Pirates, I'd probably get beat up. When I went to Chicago and went to a Pirates game and had my Pirates hat on, people are like high-fiving me and being very polite to me. And as a Pittsburgher, if anybody spent time in Pittsburgh, you don't want to do that type of stuff in Pittsburgh either. So me not getting harassed during the game, Sarah and I, was very much foreign to my experience. And I've been to a lot of sporting events. So yeah, Buffalo was similar to Pittsburgh. My dad and I got mooned one time when we went to the outdoor game there. But that people in Chicago were so friendly to us that it's a little bit strange. And just to give you an example of this, when I took my father-in-law to a Penguins game one time, I felt embarrassed because there was a fist fight in front of us at this first ever Penguins game. And I tried to explain to him, I guess this is quite common in Pittsburgh when you go to sporting events. So, but Chicago was like totally different. And I would suspect that was the same in Texas too. So yeah, big cultural difference between Texas and Pennsylvania was the way money is spent. The joke in Dallas was $40,000 millionaires. So a lot of young people had to like put the percent, which was also very strange because they had a huge high church attendance as well. So there's like this paradox, but being from growing up in Western PA, I was a bit able to see these paradoxes more where I can't see them as closely when I grew up in Pennsylvania. So yeah, that's kind of fun actually. But on the international stage, it even gets trumped up a little bit higher. So when I thought about this, so I mentioned parachurches last week. I think the way of the future is kind of church-to-church contact. The beauty about the EPC is we do have these things called fraternal relationships where you can set up church-to-church contact. That's kind of the beauty of denominationalism. So I had thought, if we are ever going to do mission trips here at Redeemer, we should go through our fraternal relationships. People work really, really hard on committees to make these happen. So, for example, we have one in Mexico. We have one in Peru. We have one in Argentina. I don't know if you're all aware of this, but when Argentina broke away from their relationship with the PCUSA, the EPC actually had a presbytery in Argentina for a while. We actually have one in, the presbytery in Florida is actually part of the Bahamas too, which the Bahamas is not part of our country. So it's kind of interesting that we have these relationships as well. But that's the picture of the church we're going to this week. They've been there for 125 years. They have a really lovely worship space and it's called the Good Shepherd. So El Buen Pastor just means the Good Shepherd in Spanish, or English, I'm sorry. So I thought, and then it just made natural sense that my wife's from Monterrey too, so in Mexico. And we spent time there. So there's a picture of Dean Weaver. I'm pretty sure that if I remember when I made this, this is the moderator from the Presbyterian Church in Argentina. That we also have a relationship with the Peruvian Presbyterians, Brazil. I don't know if you knew this, but the country that has the most percentage of Presbyterians in the whole world, I think, is Brazil. I didn't know that until I was working on this presentation. And there's more Presbyterians in Mexico than there is in the United States now. If you look, when we take pictures when we go next week, if you actually see their new membership classes at El Buen Pastor, they're extremely young. There's not too many elderly people. There are a lot of first-generation converts to faith in Christ or people that are coming into the Reformed tradition. And their church denomination is just blowing up with young people. It's actually quite encouraging, but I'm also a little bit jealous at the same time, so to speak, that's a long-term issue that we have to tackle in the EPC. But I think it naturally makes sense to have church-to-church contact. So most of the denominations that are doing this are breaking away from the PCUSA and wanting to form relationships with the EPC, especially after when DOMA was struck down in What year was that now? I can't think. 2012? Or whatever year DOMA was struck down. Defense of Marriage Act, that's what it's called. So there's Dean Weaver. So at the General Assembly level, they sign these partnerships ever so often. So I was made aware of this and actually got to sit down next to the moderator of the EPC when the official fraternal relationship was signed between the Mexican Presbyterian Church and the EPC. And I got to chat with him a little bit. His name's Scott. He's a really nice guy. So I figured if I'm sitting next to this guy who's kind of important, I should tell him that we're taking advantage of this. So, the guy in the middle. So you can kind of tell people from Argentina tend to be quite fair-skinned. If I'm correct in studying Presbyterians in Argentina, they came from Scotland and planted their churches. So I've been trying to explain this when I do church history. You can find out where the immigrants were by what type of church they planted. So that's why Presbyterian churches are usually rural, because they were farmers, so they came over and planted churches. So, on an interesting side note, Dean and I received an email this past week from the stated clerk of the EPC, Jeff Jeremiah. Stated clerk just means CEO, basically. And they had the moderator of the Mexican Presbyterian Church sent out, wanted to have a church-to-church contact. It's in the Yucatan Peninsula. And the real ironic thing there is I have a feeling that he's the pastor in the town that we lived in Mexico. So when Sarah and I had been thinking about this, we're like, we could do a partnership in the Yucatan, where the Molks are actually this week, leaving tomorrow. Or we could do it in Monterey, where Sarah grew up. And I'm like, well, we ended up picking and going with Monterey, but we probably would have emailed him anyway. So it's kind of funny. Okay, so RPC's mission trip to Mexico. So tomorrow, the Molks and the Cortinas, not from the same airport, will be going to Monterey. That's actually, now I can't think of the name. That's the famous mountain in Monterey. The whole city is kind of built around it. It's quite beautiful. One of the things that Sarah likes about Pennsylvania, I guess you have to get 20 minutes south of here, is that we have mountains. In Texas, there is none. And we both hated that. We grew up around mountains. Yes. But, I mean, you get 20 minutes on 79, and it gets pretty hilly quick. But Sarah, one of the things that she's grown to love about Western Pennsylvania is the mountains, because it reminds her of where she grew up. But that beautiful mountain's right smack dab in the middle of the city. So that's a really famous mountain. So, yes, yeah. Well, it's the same thing in Monterey. When you go to visit family there, it's like up, down. She said her grandmother used to literally live on a hill that was or a house that was built into the mountain. So, yeah.
You go up, people live up on that.
Yeah, and that's like a political issue, because you can kind of see, like right here, people are actually building into the mountain. So that's kind of like a national park. So I don't think Mexico's established like what they want to do with that type of land just yet. So it's natural for us, because of the pastor and pastor's wife, to establish partnership in Mexico. But I thought to myself, and talked to Sarah about this and the missions committee, how could RPC serve our brothers and sisters in Mexico? So theologically, I thought that's one of the strengths of our church. We have a pretty educated congregation. We do theological education well. We have a pretty high standard for Christian education hour compared to other churches. We actually build our own curriculum instead of just buying it. But I thought, well, that could be one way that we could serve the church in Mexico. So when I talked to Pastor David, or Pastor David, I pitched that to him through Sarah. He doesn't speak English, unfortunately, and I speak Spanglish, so Sarah's our
What is their theological training that the church is going to?
I'll show a picture in a little bit, but they do go to seminary, so they have a high standard. But at the same time, they're kind of doing their own type of education. I don't think they're professors are coming to study in the States just yet. They're starting to do that long term. There's a seminary called Reformed Theological Seminary. It's in Orlando. Actually, they have a few different campuses, but they've set up a partnership with them where they educate some of the future professors, and then they go back and work there. So I think he went to, there's three seminaries, one in Mexico City. Man, I know more information about this denomination than I thought. One in Mérida, actually. Mérida's a hotbed. I say this because I know Judy's been to Mérida before. Sorry. There's one there. And then there's one in Chiapas, which is kind of in western part of Mexico. So, yeah, they do have to go to seminary. So that is one of the gifts that I thought we could give. But I also asked Pastor David, how could Buen Pastor help serve us in the future as well? So the funny thing is he's all about doing future mission trip to us too. And we had assumed, okay, so how can we raise money to fly them up to Erie one day? Like, we could do that. But then Sarah's mother, when she was talking to her, said, well, you know what they're going to do? They're just going to get their vans out and they're going to drive all the way from Monterey to Erie, because that's what Mexicans do. And I was like, well, I guess that's a really long drive. But she, as a kid, she went in a van, a church van, because she grew up in Nazarene tradition, and they drove all the way from Monterey to Cincinnati, actually. And that's probably roughly about the same distance. So it just shows how your social imaginary is so American, where you think, oh, I need to get them on the plane to come, but they'll just be like, I'm just going to get into, hop into our church van, and we're just going to kind of drive up there. So that, I was thinking before in the context, if we had our own building or something, we trend as an older congregation right now. Hopefully that's starting to change. But I thought, well, if we had got our own building or rented a space and it needed painted, for example, they could come in the summer and paint for us or something like that. We just don't have the manpower as much as we might have 20, 30 years ago. But they could be a blessing to us because they're younger currently than we are. So put them to work, or we could put them in Serve Erie or something like that. So building international missions presence. That's actually a place called Sintermex in Monterey where Sarah lives. We're going to go there again this week. It's kind of like for those who have seen San Antonio, they have that river walk. It looks a lot like that. It's a couple miles and you take a boat and go on. It's quite pretty. And that used to be a steel manufacturing area. They still have it and you can look at it. So the funny thing is I married a girl that came from a town that was a hotbed for steel making, and I'm from the American city where steel making was a hotbed. They're really into sports. Pittsburghers are really into sports as well. So a lot more similarities than you would think. And then below is kind of the picture of the downtown. So that's Monterey. So I guess I've got the passion for Monterey like Sarah as well. So there you go. We could maybe, if we had a new building, they could help us painting. They also have many mission churches that are throughout the town. So they support these and uphold them. So my long-term thinking is if we have people that are interested in doing mission work, we will be able to do mission work there in the future, the more traditional stuff. And I understand from getting to know you guys that when you're at the old church, you had a partnership with the church in Jamaica. So I know, Jerry, you went to Jamaica once, right? So Jerry's been in Jamaica. Tim's been in Jamaica. Does that still exist? No? Okay. So that's kind of how my long-term vision, that you could, again, church to church, I think, is the way to go, instead of through parachurch, but you have a partnership that works out that way. I don't want to give away too much. If I deviate from my slides, I give away what I'm going to talk about in the future. So I would actually challenge young people in the future to sacrifice all the craze as vacations and 40 and under demographic, but everybody goes to the same place for vacation. So how's that for authenticity? If I hear one more story about going to Ireland, for example... It seems like everybody's going to Ireland right now. I'm picking on my sister, actually. I'm like, why are you going to Ireland? What's the history behind that? Oh, I just like the castles and want to go see them. So it just so happens she had friends that went there, too. So I'm picking on my sister. That's my job as her brother. But I would challenge younger people to sacrifice vacations and replace those with a mission trip. So I also think about... tithing in the local church. All these people are going on all these exotic trips anymore. And I'm like, where did these people get this money that my grandparents couldn't even dream to go on? And I actually think that money that was tithed to the local church goes to these crazy vacations. So I'm going to encourage them to die to self by giving up vacations to go serve people. And you can go see beautiful things as well. You can schedule in a day to do touristic stuff. Okay, so the global church... in the American church and how they work together. There's a really interesting book by Philip Jenkins called The Next Christendom. I think I've mentioned it quite a few times. And he actually argues, I think persuasively through his book, that Christendom in the Western sense is kind of gone. It's been gone for a few decades now, kind of like after the 1960s, it's got accelerated up. But throughout this book, he makes the argument that the next Christendom is more of a global type of force. So Africa, Asia, and Latin America, the churches are growing leaps and bounds, whereas in America, Canada, Western Europe, I mean, it seems like we're going kind of into the dark ages, so to speak. The future, I mean, the Lord could do something great in our social, our context that we're in, or in Western Europe, but it appears that the next Christendom is more of a global force. So some things that I see that Global South Christians are a little bit freaked out by, so to speak, that they actually see American Christians as very libertine with their church attendance. So church attendance is really, really high in the Global South. People go to church. You do something, you don't have a, or a social event, or you started a new prayer meeting or something, people just go to it. They're very, now in their defense, one of the interesting things about spending time in Mexico is they don't have as many competing forces for entertainment as we do. So maybe the church is kind of longer term as they get those opportunities. Maybe that won't happen. But Americans, I hear, are always very libertine with their church attendance. It was interesting even yesterday going to Presbytery meeting. We were talking about the sociology of Christian marriage. And he puts up high church attendance, for example, was 2 to 3 times a month, which is a little bit depressing to me, that that was considered high church attendance in the American context. But you don't see that in the global church, for example. Also, many of the people in the global church are first generation Christians, which means they're more enthusiastic maybe than their kids will be in the future. So that's a good thing. They're younger than us. It's actually really depressing reading Jenkins' book, but at the same time really refreshing, because you see the hope, the long-term hope, is kind of shifting from the United States to somewhere else, so to speak. So I don't know if you're aware of this, but a few decades ago, America used to send out more missionaries per capita than any other nation. Well, that ended up getting replaced by Korea. And Korea went from virtually no Christians overnight to a ton, and then they sent out the most missionaries per capita. So, I mean, the Lord could do something really interesting and really new. So perhaps the best way going forward for us is to conceive Christianity as a global movement, not so much through the lens of just America. And that's kind of what Jenkins' book is arguing for. It's a really good book. It's really entertaining. Don't let Oxford University Press scare you away. It's long, but it's actually, he's a really good writer. He's written a ton of books. He's a professor at Baylor. I think originally he's a criminologist, but then shifted to doing church history. I don't know how Penn State let him do that. That's where he taught before he went to Baylor, but now he writes on topics like this, so they're quite fascinating to me. But I should, to retort, Christianity has always been a global force. So, for example, it spread to Africa and Asia before it actually ever got to Europe. And Christianity is not synonymous with Western culture. So if anybody says, oh, that's what Christianity is, you can tell them St. Augustine's from modern-day Algeria and is not a white person. So he would look a lot different. Or Athanasius, one of the great church fathers, his nickname was actually the Black Dwarf. He was really short. He's very dark-skinned. But people were scared of the Black Dwarf because he could beat them down with his theological precision, so to speak. So Christianity was kind of the hotbed in North Africa. So it's kind of like going back to where it was the cradle for a long time. It wasn't always just Europe. Okay, so monetary gifts to the church. So you can support seminary students in the Global South. So this is San Pablo Theological Seminary in Mérida, Mexico. So it's interesting that you could theoretically support, and this isn't just in Mexico, but other places as well. And I know Lori's not here today, but she had mentioned in the past they had supported somebody and they were able to pay for his whole entire theological education as a church, where that would just be impossible in the American context. I mean, to support somebody to finish seminary for us in the American context would cost $30,000. Where you could support somebody in Mexico, Argentina, or some of these other countries for less than like $100 a month, which is just crazy. But you can also, again, see how the Lord has given us gifts and our money, but we're also required to give it to others and serve them as well. So could do that in the future. Supporting missions in the Global South often goes further than in the Western world. For example, our mission to Sierra Leone, It's really hard for us, unfortunately, to compete with the federal government in the United States. Just for us to set up a medical mission, I don't even know if that would be possible. I know some churches do it, but they usually have doctors in their congregation. But to be able to set that up in the United States is just really, really difficult. Whereas if you go to the Global South, you can go further and bless people. I know churches before that have had dentists in their congregation, and they'll go to Nepal and help people with their teeth, which was really cool because they don't have access to dental care there. But it seems like the medical support can go a lot further in the Global South than it can in the United States. Has anybody partook of medical missions before? No? Okay. I know, like been part of a team that did a medical mission. I know your home church, or I keep saying home church, your church in Hartford, you guys supported a lot of international missionaries, right? Yeah, that's a good chunk. Was anybody distinctly doing medical type of missions? Yeah, so, and the gentleman, I remember with the Ebola crisis, I'm striking out remembering his name through Samaritan's Purse. He was a doctor that almost died and had to come back from Africa a few years ago. So the most important thing is we are demonstrating that we value heavenly rewards more than earthly rewards. So I believe vacations are somewhat overvalued. That's coming from Global South people. They say that vacations are a little bit overrated. So I have had experience with this in the past. In our home church, Mount Lebanon EPC actually has done this. So I have a framework to operate in going forward in the future. But they had a family come from Kenya. Their last name is Omberi. That is their son. I can't remember her name, but Presbytery kind of made me tired from yesterday. Josh is his name. He was part of our small group. And his dad's name is James. I cannot remember the wife's name because it's a very ethnic name, so I'm striking out on remembering her name. But they came from Kenya and then came to live in the United States and actually joined our church. And our church actually didn't have any type of mission presence at the time. So when he got on session, he was like, well, what are we doing with missions? We're just kind of like cutting checks. There's real opportunity in the area that I grew up in to do mission work. So a lot of what they did is they asked questions like, how can we serve them, et cetera. We had some engineers in our congregation. They went over and set up a water well in Kenya, which they needed. And the way that they do it is every other year we sent a team to Kenya to do a mission trip. And the next year they would have the pastors come and preach and teach and do things like that in Mount Lebanon. So they would switch every other year. So it was pretty cool. So you had kind of a reciprocity there. That's Steve Aguzzi. He's the associate pastor there. His joke, I put this picture on there, is he says that he ate that cow behind him the next day for dinner. So I always like to say that joke. I've been in a Mayan village before in Mexico where we were doing a Bible study with a lady, a family, and they had a turkey that they were probably going to kill that week to eat. But the turkey kept coming next to Sarah and I and annoying us, so she would just kind of shoo the turkey away. And it's like, I've never been in a Bible study before where a turkey kept interrupting sharing God's word, but it was kind of funny. And then the gentleman's just kind of sitting in his hammock, because they only have like huts in a one big room, and then there's this turkey that keeps trying to bug us while we're doing our Bible study. So it was a pretty cool story to see them. And the church really got behind it. And I mean, it's still a big deal for people to go to Africa. I personally feel a lot more safe going to Mexico than Africa. That's a big commitment to get on a plane and take all those shots. And I don't have to take any shots when I go to Mexico, but that's a big commitment. But, yeah, I always thought that was funny when Pastor Steve said, yeah, we had that cow for dinner the next night. So did you eat eat the goat? Okay. Hey, you're from Western PA. You're used to, I know the joke. My best friend's from West Virginia. They always joke about eating roadkill. So he, when he was on session, persuaded them to do a mission trip, and it kind of unfolded into this big partnership that they do. So they're not Presbyterians, but they kind of have a church to church contact since James is from Kenya. He knows the people that are from there. So it's just a really cool story. But the thing that's really interesting from my perspective is they were kind of doing this reciprocity gift giving already. they were thinking, okay, when we bring the pastors over from Kenya, what can they kind of challenge us when they're preaching and teaching? And our home church also had this big local mission every year called Mission Possible. I actually was in the Mill Creek Mall a few weeks ago and saw somebody with a shirt that I didn't know if they were from our home church or not. They probably were, but I didn't know who they were. But I was like, oh, that's Mission Possible. That's the local mission. But they did this local mission. They would bring the pastors over from Africa to help serve there. But and then they would preach and teach and do things like that. But they were kind of setting this up as a mutual relationship. So it was through the lens of gift giving. So instead of just cutting a check, James didn't go to Session and say, let's just give a bunch of money to all these friends that I have in Africa. But let's actually set up a partnership. And they've been going at it over a decade now. It's a pretty cool story. So the missions challenge I would issue to you guys today. So perhaps in the future, I know our group's a little bit older, but you could sacrifice a vacation in the future to go on a mission trip. So my long-term plan is to hopefully offer mission trips yearly, probably more like every other year. Ideally, I think you would have the church that you partner with come send a team to us here in Pennsylvania and vice versa. So you kind of set it up like our home church. I think that worked really, really well. So due to age or health, if you cannot go on a mission trip, consider supporting missionaries or missions with monetary gifts and prayers as much as possible. And finally, I think RPC should try to work within the fraternal relationships that our denomination has established. I know General Assembly works hard to set up these partnerships to be formed, and that's why Dean and I got that email. They want us to work through fraternal relationships. I guess if you've learned one thing about your pastor so far, I'm an institutionalist. I believe in the institution, the EPC, and I like working through the institution. I really believe the EPC is very unique and does a really good job. So I like working through fraternal relationships. I like that idea. So, and then they put a lot of work into this type of stuff as well. So in conclusion, for those who remember, that's Immanuel Kant, who I had mentioned that we have to exercise out. I put a big X through. I'm really convinced in like biblical studies, theology, everything goes back. If it has issues, it always goes back to Immanuel Kant for some reason. So nobody knows who he is, but he's influenced you a lot more than you would probably dare to know. So I always think, oh, this is a problem. And like, oh, this goes back to Immanuel Kant. So I hope Immanuel Kant has been exorcised from our false understandings of gifts in the Bible. So again, giving a gift with strings attached, or to better say, through reciprocity, is okay. And it's actually encouraged in the Bible. I think viewing all missions through gift giving and reciprocity helps us think about missions in new and exciting ways. At least I get fired up about it. Don't know about you. And ideally, all missions should reflect the Great Commission given by the Lord Jesus. So get rid of Immanuel Kant. Like I said with the illustration about Social Security, I actually don't know the economist that came up with it, but if you have a bad idea and thinking, I bet I could trace it back to some professor who taught somewhere at one time. Professors have a lot more power to shape people than they think. They might not shape people when they're alive, but when they're dead. But I always think that's kind of funny. Okay, well, if you don't have any questions, we can conclude with that. Thank you, guys.